snowed out, but it was already too late. An undercurrent of electricity cut the air. It was as if the vines were suddenly coming alive, sending a pulsating tremor through the entire building. Kate watched over Sammy's shoulders at the signals and words scrolling across the computer engineer's screen. They had spent the past couple days since Beckham and the others left in the parking garage of the hospital outside Houston, connected to the webbing in the nearby gaping tunnel.
"Whoa, did you see that?" Sammy asked.
She pointed at a sudden spike in signaling activity.
"It's all coming from Vegas," Sammy said.
Kate thought of her husband and her friends on the mission. She almost couldn't bear the thought of them out there risking their lives, but she had to focus and play her part. "Reed and the others should be at the sites where we think the Prophet is by now," she said.
"Yeah, seems like this influx of activity could be related. What can you tell so far?"
Sammy pointed at some of the words scrolling across the screen.
"It seems like we're advancing faster than the variants expected."
"Maybe they weren't ready for us," Kate said. The unease in her stomach made her question whether she actually believed those words.
"There's something bad here, though," Sammy said.
She pointed at another message.
"Some collaborators are reporting they captured a special ops team."
Kate resisted the urge to cover her mouth.
"A Canadian team," Sammy said.
"Oh, God.
You okay?"
Kate stepped away from Sammy's computer.
"No, but I have to be. I will be."
She turned from the monitor. Leslie was still strapped into the network. She and Kate had been taking two-hour turns for the past 6 straight hours, trying to disrupt the variant's communications in Vegas by sending fake messages and commands. So far, they had managed to divert a couple of packs of variants and groups of collaborators, sending them into the outskirts of the cities where no Allied States troops were. The more wild goose chases they went on, the better.
"The variants sound desperate," Sammy said. "They keep requesting reinforcements, and many have retreated out of the areas where our forces are pushing forward."
A few guards situated around the parking garage were looking their way, sharing expressions of relief to hear the direction the battle was going in.
"I think they might actually be scared," Sammy said.
Kate hoped she was right. Footsteps pounded down the stairs to the garage. Ron came running from the stairwell toward them, waving a notebook.
"I found something!"
He was nearly out of breath when he slammed the notebook onto the table. On an open page were lists of names. Some were crossed out, and others were connected by lines.
"I cross-referenced all the principal investigators of the biodefense and bioengineering-related projects under DARPA's umbrella," he said.
"And you found a match to all the technologies we've uncovered?" Kate asked.
"Not exactly," Ron said. "There were a few labs that worked with the strain of anthrax we found in that grenade, but there was no overlap with them and the neural engineering groups."
Kate frowned.
"Are you sure we aren't missing a government lab from that list?"
"Positive," Ron said.
"Those labs in Seattle and Denver were the only places the computer interface and microarray research were taking place."
"Damn.
So how are they connected to DARPA biodefense research?"
"That's the thing. They aren't connected. Not really, anyway."
"So the anthrax samples were..."
Ron flipped to another page in his notebook.
"The particular strain we found was a lab-created strain that I tracked all the way back to a Soviet Union program, Biopreparat."
"Wait, so this is some international plot now?" Sammy asked.
No. Ron waved his hands. "Not even close. Lab records indicate this strain was stored at Fort Detrick in Maryland with USAMRIT. The only people with access to it were biodefense specialists in the government and a few federal contractor groups."
"Which contractors?" Kate asked.
"All the usual suspects, Leiden, Blackwell, and BAH, but ignore those."
He jabbed his index finger at a single name on the paper.
"Here's the rub. This company, Orgoprot, was the only contractor I didn't recognize."
Kate narrowed her eyes, studying the name. It sounded vaguely familiar, but she couldn't figure out why.
"Where did you find all this stuff?"
"A mixture of public records and old DARPA archives."
"What do we know about Orgoprot?"
Ron flipped to a page with a map. On it, He had circled various locations, including Seattle and Denver, that had names written next to them. You remember Dr. Simon Wong from the University of Florida? Well, we already knew he was involved in computer neural interface research that took place in the California Bay Area and Seattle. He moved his finger to Denver. There was another research group here led by Dr. Jennifer Yates. They specialized in communication networks, mostly digital, cybersecurity-type stuff. Next, he circled Portland, Oregon. Dr. Bhushan Reddy had an academic group that focused on genetic engineering of viral agents here. Is that our guy? Sammy asked. I can't say for certain, but I don't think so, Ron said. He continued, pointing to various locations around the former United States and listing names associated with projects investigating technologies that might have been related to the Chimeras, Webbing Network, Masterminds, and more. All these people were doing DARPA-funded research? Kate asked. Many, but not all. Then how are they connected? Ron had never looked so confident and self-assured. It all goes back to Orgoprocht. Each of these people served as a scientific advisor for the organization at one time or another. Everything suddenly clicked together for Kate. Good Lord. If it wasn't someone in DARPA, if it wasn't some government scientist, their connection is through Orgoprocht, she said. Exactly, Ron said. He rubbed his hands together. This is what really tipped me off. Several of those unknown compounds we found in the Chimera's tissues were residuals from the gene delivery system of the modified VX-99 administered to the Chimera. I found an exact match from that same viral vector delivery system in Orgoprocht's research reports that they submitted to the Department of Defense. And what was that delivery system supposed to be for? Kate asked. It was supposed to deliver a set of genes targeting specific human cells, Ron said. Hold up, Sammy said. What kind of genes are we talking about? The genes were made to reverse the effects of VX-99 and X9H9. Oh my God, Kate muttered. Then she recalled where she had heard of the company before. I remember Orgoprocht's reports years ago during the Great War. They were one of the many labs that tried to find a cure for X9H9 back when I was also searching for it. The government was enlisting every lab, every scientist they possibly could. But obviously Orgoprocht didn't succeed, did they? I don't think so, he said. The last report was sent 2 days before you developed the bioweapon called Variant X9H9. Kate winced at the name of the bioweapon, guilt eating at her for what she had created. It was meant to destroy the monsters that X9H9 had created. It worked, killing most, but it also had unintended consequences, turning those that survived into the variants that plagued the world today. All of that seemed like a lifetime ago, but now it was more relevant than ever. Can I see that last report? Kate asked. She took the paper from Ron, skimming through the lengthy graphs and tables of data until she reached the final summary. We're losing time. Most of our staff has succumbed to X9H9, including myself. I don't have the luxury to prepare for human trials, so instead, I will try our cure on myself. I can already feel the fever settling in and the nausea. If this is the last transmission from us, you will know we failed. Orgoprocht's efforts to reverse the genetic effects caused by X9H9 will have failed. The Angel of Death will have swept through the final survivors in Los Alamos National Labs. I only wish we could have had more time. Charles Morgan, Orgoprocht, Chief Scientific Officer. Los Alamos? Kate asked. Ron nodded. Like many research companies, they were frequent users of Los Alamos National Laboratories. Much of their early research creating computational models of X9H9 and VX99 took place there. I see, Kate said. So this Charles Morgan, is he our guy? Sounds like he might have died after he administered his own drug, huh? Sammy said. Ron shrugged. There's no way to confirm it. But if he was trying to reverse the genetic effects of X9H9 at the same time we deployed variant X9H9 across the nation, what if there was some kind of genetic interference? Kate asked. What if our bioweapon negatively interacted with the effects of his? Ron nearly stumbled.
You're saying...
Even Sammy followed their train of logic now.
Chimeras.
His engineered drugs reversed some of the genetic changes as intended, but your variant X9H9 made other changes.
It's just a theory, Kate said. It might be entirely wrong. But it fits. I think you might be onto something.
Ron looked at the ceiling as if deep in thought.
Maybe I can run some simulations, see if this theory holds any merit.
Okay, Kate said. Ron started to head towards the stairs. Something else bothered Kate. Thanks to Ron's list, they were able to explain the various hives of New God and Mastermind activity they had discovered throughout the Allied States. But there was one city name that she hadn't heard.
Ron, wait, she called out.
Was Orgoprocht located in Vegas? Is that why there's so much variant activity there? Ron looked at his notebook.
No, Orgoprocht was in Santa Fe, close to Los Alamos.
Were any of those research groups you mentioned in Vegas?
Not a single one.
Then why are the New Gods there, especially if Orgoprocht was in New Mexico?
I don't know, Ron said.
Kate wanted to be satisfied with the revelations he had uncovered, but the fact they had found no connections between the New Gods, Vegas, and any of these researchers and their respective research groups nagged at her. They were missing something, and there was almost no time to find out what.
We've got to tell Ringgold, Kate said. I don't know if this Charles Morgan is our guy or if Orgoprocht somehow became the epicenter of the New Gods in Los Alamos, but soldiers are dying in Las Vegas, and if the Prophet isn't actually there, it's all for nothing.
13. Timothy crouched in the darkness. Gunfire sounded from nearly every direction. The flash of tracer fire coursed through the black night, and beasts howled and roared. So far, the attacks had come in random intervals from packs of three or four. Timothy glanced at the Wynn Hotel through his NVGs. While the name was still visible, most of the front glass facade had shattered. Only sporadic panes of glass remained. Each of the dark rooms was a potential sniper position for collaborators or scions. Every step felt like it could be his last, his nerves tight from the potential of a sniper bullet. While Wong was on point and Boyd watched their back on rear guard, Ruckley remained closer to him, watching the windows and rooftops. Ahead, he saw another hotel that had fallen into utter disrepair. The letters on the building's side said, Sure Island. Wong paused next to a military truck with deflated, rotten tires. Claw marks scarred the paint. He pointed to his eyes, then toward their right, to what looked like the entrance to a mall nearly 40 yards away. Webbing stretched from the broken glass doors and windows, curling over the concrete. There was no mistaking the shadows moving within the structure. Pale creatures crawled over the tangled vines. Ruckley pulled out her infrared binoculars and scanned the neighboring buildings. Then, she gestured toward a site that Timothy recognized from his briefings. The Grand Canal Shops at the Venetian. That was their target. Ruckley handed the binos to Timothy. Another squad of soldiers was hunched down across the street. She exchanged hand signals with the other team lead. Dozens of variants crawled over the Grand Canal Shops. On the roof and in the darkened windows, he saw other moving shapes. It was difficult to tell if they were human or chimera, but he could clearly see that they carried rifles.
Looks like a hive, Timothy whispered. Just like the science team said.
We can't go straight at the building, Boyd said. They'd cut us down before we got there.
You got that right.
Ruckley pointed to a panel of grating on the sidewalk that led to a storm drain. That's why we're going underground. Another rash of gunfire echoed somewhere to the south. Probably TF Bravo caught in another firefight. Timothy felt the smooth wooden beads of his bracelet. He found strength in the simple touch as he watched Ruckley exchange more hand signals with the other squad leaders. The teams both got up and started to move into position to provide a distraction. As soon as the first gunshot rang out and the other squads were pounding the variants roaming around the Grand Canal Shops, Ruckley gave the order to advance. Keeping low, Timothy hurried across the street, again bracing himself for incoming rounds and dodging between debris for shelter. He made it across the street a minute later with the rest of the team. Boyd and Wong lifted the grate from the sidewalk, heaving it to the side. It let out a jarring scrape against the concrete, and Timothy crouched instinctively, scanning their surroundings with his rifle. All the beasts and collaborators were too distracted by the incoming gunfire from the other squads to notice. The distraction was working. Ruckley signaled Wong down first. Timothy followed. Then came Boyd and Ruckley. The stench of the place slammed into Timothy like he had run straight into a wall. He pulled a handkerchief over his nose and mouth. Goosebumps prickled across his skin. Without any light deeper in the tunnel, they were forced to flip up their NVGs and turn on their tack lights. Slowly, they navigated through the massive concrete tunnel. Webbing covered every surface, throbbing red in the pale wash of their flashlights. Between the echoing fire above ground, he listened for the scrape of claws down here, waiting for an ambush.
Keep moving, Timothy. Just keep moving.
Like his father had always told him, no matter what you did in life, you kept pushing forward. He kept close to Ruckley, making their way past the rotting bodies of humans and animals stuck to the walls. Fissures in the concrete let through columns of shifting dirt and dust with each walloping boom of an exploding grenade above. So far, it seemed the attack was working. The monsters were focusing on the main assault force. Teams like his, Recon Sigma, and the others could move into position within the Venetian and set explosives. Then, once Beckham and Horn or Team Ghost confirmed they had caught the Prophet, they would bring this whole damn hive down. The storm drain dragged on. Another heavy thudding explosion caused a violent crack in the ceiling. Small chunks of concrete fell over their heads. As the blast settled, Timothy heard a loud thump. Wong held up a fist, and they all dropped into kneeling positions, lights aimed down the tunnel. Something huge burst into an intersection about 50 yards ahead, white flesh with massive limbs and bat-like ears. The beast turned their direction, letting out a shrill series of clicks, its ears twitching. Timothy sucked in a breath at the sight of the monster. It was an alpha. Ruckley gave the signal, and they opened fire. The beast ducked into their gunfire, bullets riddling its flesh and sparking against the concrete around it. It barreled ahead on all fours, letting out a guttural roar. Other hellish voices echoed behind the monster. Another 5 variants galloped behind the brute, stringy muscles rippling beneath their skin. As rounds lanced into the alpha, it shuddered, absorbing the impacts and slowing. Timothy heard another series of shrieks coming from behind. He twisted, his flashlight illuminating the tunnel they had already traveled through. A group of 10 juvenile variants with armored flesh chased after them. "Ruckley, our 6!" Timothy shouted. She was probably doing the math like he was. The beasts were too close, too many of them. They couldn't sustain a firefight without solid cover, especially not against the armored juveniles. Ruckley grabbed a grenade from her vest, motioning for Timothy to do the same. Beckham had taught him that a concussive blast in a confined place like this was risky. The force would be concentrated by the walls, tearing them apart if they threw the grenades too close to their positions. If the blasts didn't destroy their organs, then it might bring the roof down on top of them. From the front, the Alpha let out an angry yell, stumbling toward them, one of its legs limp. The other 5 creatures behind it rushed past. One fell in the gunfire. Another was shredded. The 10 juveniles were closing in from behind, too, jaws snapping, lips smacking together.
"Fire in the hole," Ruckley said.
She threw her grenade like a major league pitcher. Timothy followed her lead. The 2 grenades sailed toward the juveniles, but the beasts were too fast. They surged past the grenades. Timothy swung his rifle up right when the first grenade detonated. The tunnel shook. Flames danced behind the monsters, swallowing part of the tunnel. Several juveniles were knocked off their feet. Then the 2nd grenade exploded. This time, the fissures in the ceiling spread with the expanding fire. More of the creatures stumbled. Timothy was knocked off his feet by the blast. He hit the ground hard, his ears ringing, head pounding. Ruckley grimaced next to him, blinking away the pain. More concrete chunks fell from the ceiling. Like an avalanche, the tunnel began collapsing behind them, swallowing the entrance they had come through with a monstrous roar. Pieces rained from the ceiling on the dazed juveniles. They tried to stand and scramble away, but falling concrete crushed their bodies. The ceiling didn't stop collapsing after the beasts were swallowed in the rubble. The tide of destruction came toward Timothy and Ruckley.
"Move!" Ruckley yelled.
She jumped to her feet and grabbed Timothy, pulling him into a run. Boyd and Wong were in the process of changing their magazines while two injured variants and the hobbled Alpha stumbled toward them. Timothy tried to keep his rifle steady, but he was too shaky and didn't have a clear field of fire.
"Out of the way!" Ruckley shouted.
She stepped between Wong and Boyd and drained her magazine into the two beasts, then Boyd and Wong finished off the Alpha with bullets to its milky blind eyes. The giant finally slumped forward, dead. A cloud of gray dust and debris flooded around them as they rushed past the dead creatures. Timothy tried to breathe, but choked on the dust, coughing. There was no going back the way they had come. There was only one direction to go now, just like his father had said. Forward. Covered in dust, Wong led them to a short ladder that took them to a loading dock for the Venetian. A pair of variants hunched near the entrance, on alert from the noise that had erupted from the tunnels. Ruckley and Timothy fired a few suppressed shots that killed the beasts, then hurried past the fresh corpses. They followed the loading bay to the maintenance corridors that ran behind the shops and guest rooms. Wong took them through another door that opened into a wide space with a faux sky and false facades that made Timothy think he had stepped straight into Europe. Canals ran alongside the shops. The water had long since drained from them, and a pair of long gondolas lay sideways on the bottom. Red webbing smothered everything, throbbing and squirming. More bodies hung from the walls and the ceiling, like a spider's web filled with fresh prey. Ruckley pointed at Wong and Boyd. They prepared the fuses and detonation charges for a pair of C4 explosives and set them into the corners of the wide atrium, then started to move to the next space. Before they climbed a short bridge over the dried-out canal, a rumble shook through the hotel. They froze as another quake shook the walls. A low explosion sounded in the distance. Had one of the other teams detonated their explosives early, or had Recon Sigma missed the mark and set their explosions late? Ruckley looked between them frantically and broke radio silence.
"Command, Recon Sigma 1, we heard explosions. What's going on?"
"Recon Sigma, other units are reporting blasts from unknown sources."
Another explosion boomed through the walls, this one sounding closer to the Venetian. Cracks formed in the ceiling and chunks of plaster rained down. Somewhere deeper in the hotel, another blast went off, this one nearly deafening, and the whole building quivered as if it might fall. Timothy stared at the empty corridors, realizing suddenly why the only resistance they had faced was outside.
"Guys, what are those drones doing down there?" Boyd asked.
He shone his flashlight over a cluster of barrels with wires coming away from them.
"Those aren't ours," Wong said.
"Run!"
Ruckley shouted.
"Go!"
They were nearly at the loading dock when another explosion ripped through the hotel and shops, fire exploding through the doorways and windows. Ruckley and Wong disappeared behind a screen of falling rubble.
"Ruckley!"
Timothy yelled. He rushed back to the mound of broken wreckage, choking on the dust and smoke. Another fissure ripped across the ceiling, spilling debris and fire that blocked his path.
"This whole place is going to come down,"
Boyd screamed. He grabbed Timothy and pulled him away from a fragmented hunk of ceiling that crashed to the ground. Another rumble tore through the building. The wall to the loading dock collapsed, and Timothy stumbled through a billowing cloud of dust and ash. Lowering his helmet, he pushed through the grit. Boyd was just ahead, almost to the open loading dock. Another wall crumbled, coming down with the ceiling and burying them, feet away from the exit.
"Hostile down," Beckham said.
He lowered his rifle after dispatching a rogue variant. It was one of the only creatures they had encountered so far. He was starting to worry Kate's team had been wrong about the Prophet being located in the palazzo. The booms and explosions from nearby blasts that had rocked the building worried him even more. If they were on the wrong track, it could prove deadly. A few teams had reported seeing explosives that did not belong to the Allied States, and command had warned all ground forces to keep an eye out for improvised explosive devices. He had heard Recon Sigma, Timothy and Ruckley's team, calling command to request clarification on the explosives. Since then, they had been silent. He hoped that was a good sign, that it meant they were still on target. But he could not help the worry filtering through his mind that maybe he was wrong. Nonetheless, he continued to lead Horn through the Palazzo's casino. Webbing stretched from the ceiling between the slot machines and card tables. They sifted through a lounge with dusty booths and toppled tables and chairs. Another rash of explosions rocked through Vegas, small columns of dust falling from the ceiling. Their time to find the evil creature responsible for this madness was definitely running out, and his pulse thundered in his ears with each consecutive blast. The radios came alive with the voices of frantic soldiers calling for help. Another explosion shook the palazzo, this one much closer than the others. Horn shifted around nervously.
That was way too close.
Another boom shook the tower. This time it sounded like it had come from the Venetian, where the recon teams were supposed to lay explosives to bring down the variant hives. That was the second blast near Timothy's location.
I'm breaking radio silence, Beckham said, no longer able to contain his worry. Recon Sigma, Reaper 1, do you copy?
No answer.
Recon Sigma, do you copy?
Come on, come on.
Still no answer.
They had to move.
On me, Beckham said.
He took them back through the casino, smashing over the organic webbing. They raced toward the lobby just as another rumble tore through the building. Marble columns fell on either side of them, slamming into the floor.
This way,
Beckham said, taking them out of the palazzo and through the shops in front. They raced between the stores, the whole complex quaking. Dark smoke clogged the corridors. Pieces of the ornate facades fell away in miniature rock slides. They were nearing the exit when cracks fissured through the ceiling and part of it came down in front of them. Pipes and support beams swung dangerously just a foot or two from their faces. Beckham navigated around the deadly obstacles. He struggled to breathe, the smoke filling his lungs as they advanced into another smoke and dust-filled atrium. A few columns surrounding an ivory statue toppled. Glass rained down from a dome in the roof, slashing at their ACUs and armor. One large piece shattered on Horn's helmet, but he barely flinched. As Beckham ran, he thought of Timothy, praying the young man was out of the Venetian. But something had definitely gone wrong. The detonations weren't supposed to happen for another hour, and with Recon Sigma not responding, his mind filled with dark possibilities. Had Timothy been trapped inside, buried under the rubble? Beckham felt a chill trace his spine at the thought. He shouldered his rifle through a cloud of smoke, cautious of any ambushing variants. He thought he heard the sound of clicking joints, but it could have been the structure coming down in all the chaotic clamor. Finally, he saw the exit doors and rushed out onto a landing where he paused to stare in horror. Up and down the strip, casinos were caught in rolling, oily clouds of smoke and ash illuminated by ravenous flames. The biting air stung his eyes and lungs, hearkening back Operation Liberty, back in those last days of the First War when he had run through New York streets as the entire city imploded, caught in a massive bombing run. Only this time, it wasn't his side doing the bombing. Illuminated by the roaring flames devouring the city, the silhouettes of monstrous shapes flitted between the smoke clouds descending on scattered soldiers fleeing the destruction. TF Alpha was surrounded and attacked by chimeras, collaborators, and variants. Other soldiers took cover behind burned-out cars and trucks or slabs of concrete, only to be overwhelmed by gunfire or an Alpha erupting from a manhole, leading a pack of variants. Beckham desperately looked for a way he could turn the tide of this battle. But despite their experience in the field, he and Horn were just two retired operators. They were not equipped for this onslaught.
Contacts on our 10, Horn said.
He unloaded a hailstorm of lead, ripping into three charging beasts. Geysers of blood sprayed from where rounds tore into their bodies. The monsters tumbled over their own dead limbs.
Don't fuck with the mountain, Horn bellowed.
He fired another burst at a pack, cutting all three down before they could get too close. Beckham searched for a way out, but something held him in position. He had made a promise to Timothy, and now that it was clear the Prophet had laid an ambush, all that mattered to him was finding the young man and getting him out of here. He wouldn't leave Timothy behind a second time.
"Recon Sigma, please respond," Beckham said.
Another explosion erupted behind them. Heat rolled over them, searing Beckham's skin. He urged them forward, heading south along the strip. The palazzo trembled, large portions of the walls giving way, glass bursting from the windows. The entire tower fell into itself, letting out a grating protest of screeching metal and tumbling concrete. Huge clouds of debris puffed into the air, mixing with pillars of flame and black smoke. Beckham took to the sidewalk, ducking with Horn behind a wall as a wave of dust and grit surged over them. The tsunami of powdery air covered them, grit pelting them. Spikes of pain stabbed all over his exposed flesh. Despite holding his breath, Beckham still got some of it into his lungs, prompting a guttural cough. A voice crackled over the main channel. "All teams be advised, air support and evac en route to extraction points, ETA 15 mics." Horn looked at Beckham for orders, coughing deeply.
"I'm not going to that extraction point now," Beckham said, eyes watering from the smoke. "I've got to find Timothy. You can go if you want." "You think I want to leave without that guy? Hell no. Let's go get him."
Horn led the way toward the Venetian where Timothy's team would have set their charges. Beckham struggled to breathe as he moved, his battered muscles screaming for oxygen that wouldn't make it to them. But the thought of finding Recon Sigma fueled him with energy.
"You okay?"
Horn asked. He stopped to let Beckham catch up.
"Don't stop moving," Beckham said.
Horn checked him with a quick flick of his eyes, then pushed onward, navigating the piles of scree toward what was left of the loading dock of the Venetian. An iron girder had smashed a semi-truck. Part of a wall had flattened another truck. Dead variants littered the ground, and others were crushed in the remains of broken crates and fractured concrete. Beckham spotted an arm reaching out of a pile. The gloved hand told him it wasn't a monster. Horn and Beckham rushed over to the buried soldier. They heaved off the crates to reveal a torso and a head, badly burned. The face was nearly unrecognizable, charred and bleeding. His name tape read Wong.
"Hey, brother, are you with me?" Horn asked.
"Help."
"We're getting you help."
He hated lying, but he could tell the wounded soldier wasn't long for this world. Horn suddenly got up and ran over to a bundle of pipes. A death rattle escaped the lips of the man Beckham was with. Beckham had seen this before. Sometimes soldiers hung on just long enough to not die alone. He closed the guy's eyes, saying a brief prayer in his head, and hurried over to Horn. He was already lifting pipes off Ruckley, tossing them like they were nothing but sticks. As he uncovered her, Beckham saw the extent of her injuries. Half the sleeve on her right arm was torn, her arm burned and blistered. Her left sleeve had been burned off, too. The stitches from her injuries along her bicep had been torn open again, puckering to reveal the glistening red beneath.
"Ruckley," Horn said, strapping his machine gun over his back.
He started to lift her.
"We're going to get you out of here."
Beckham kept his rifle trained toward the street.
"Contacts back across the street."
The cacophony of gunfire and flames nearly drowned out his voice. He put a hand on Horn's shoulder.
"We need to get out of here." "We're not leaving her here. She's still alive."
Horn cradled Ruckley in his arms. She groaned, eyes fluttering open.
"Master Sergeant," she muttered.
"Where's the rest of your team?" Beckham asked.
Ruckley winced.
I don't know.
14. Instead, she took a breath, trying to keep control while everything was spiraling away from her. Once again, the new gods had overwhelmed their forces in a matter of hours, and like before, she was left wondering how. She hoped someone on her team, anyone, could tell her something helpful, but so far, General Cornelius, General Souza, and Lieutenant Festa didn't know anything more than she did. Her team wasn't doing much better at keeping their emotions in check than she was. Festa and Sousa both wore grimaces on their face like they had knives twisting into their sides. "Someone, anyone, give me a sit rep," she said. "What the hell is going on?"
"Our teams are being routed and pushed back from the strip," Sousa said. "They're taking heavy losses."
"Then get them out of there now," Ringgold said in a voice just shy of a shout.
"We're trying to execute selective evacuation protocols," Cornelia said.
"Everywhere we try to ID an LZ, it turns hot in seconds," Sousa added. "Primary and secondary LZs are occupied by hostiles. There are no clear evac sites."
"Then make some," Ringgold said, losing her patience. "We need to help these people. Can we reroute them somewhere we can secure?"
"We're working on that, ma'am," Cornelia said, face growing red with frustration.
He joined some of the officers huddled around the computers at the side of the room. They pored over the maps and monitors displayed in front of them, voices rising frantically. Another team of communications officers manned computers coordinating the movements of the two task forces through the streets of Las Vegas. A 55-inch monitor on one wall showed a map of the city, along with red blips to indicate where the ground forces had spotted hostiles. Green blips designated the locations of Allied troops. Too many of those green blips representing individual divisions and squads had already been crossed out as reports of confirmed KIAs filtered in. She watched another rash of green blips get crossed out, and an almost palpable pain struck through her gut.
"I'm getting confirmation that the explosions the teams are reporting aren't from our demo crews," Sousa said. "The bombs going off were planted well before our teams got there."
"What? But—" Ringgold began to say.
"This was a trap," Cornelia said dryly.
"They set enough explosives to bring down the whole damn city. They knew we were coming."
"How?" Ringgold asked. "How are they ahead of us every single damn time?" No one had an answer and avoided her gaze. Ringgold looked back down at the message Kate had sent her hours earlier. The doctor had reported a Santa Fe-based company operating out of Los Alamos National Laboratory called Orgoproct. Their science division was led by Charles Morgan, which seemed to link all the strange technologies of the new gods. The evidence was circumstantial at best, but the story seemed to make more sense as Ringgold thought about it. The most startling revelation was that the new gods had no known ties to Las Vegas. Was this a new god stronghold? Was it even an actual base? Maybe it wasn't. Maybe this was all a facade. One thing was certain. The Prophet was more intelligent than any alpha she had faced in the past decade. She was going to have to think well outside of the box to beat the evil abomination. "Have we found any of their leadership?" Ringgold asked.
"No," Sousa replied. "However, Team Ghost is still within the UMC where they reported strong resistance. That kind of resistance might indicate new gods' leaders are nearby."
"So there's still hope," Ringgold said, clinging to any remote chance they might yet succeed with their initial objective. But that ephemeral hope was fading with every KIA reported on the monitor. "Have we heard anything from Ghost recently?"
"Not since they went radio silent.
Almost all other units, even those on the retreat, are still engaged in skirmishes," Cornelia said, returning to the table.
He clicked a button on his keyboard, and the main monitor in the room shifted to the view from a helmet-mounted camera on a TF Bravo squad leader. The rattle of gunfire sizzled over the speakers. Flames erupted over the parapets of the Excalibur Hotel. A few of the towers on the castle had crumbled.
"Hostiles at our 12 and 3,
a voice yelled over the speakers. More flashes of tracer fire cut through the black of night. Ghoulish screams filled the calm as monsters swarmed from the flames, hurtling over the debris and ripping into the soldiers. Ringgold turned away at the sound of tearing flesh and anguished yells.
"This is what the evac sites look like," Cornelia said, voice weak.
Cornelius switched to a feed from a helicopter. A door gunner manned an M249 as the chopper swooped low over the fires spreading through the Vegas streets. The gunner raked machine gun fire over a pack of variants, riddling their diseased flesh with bullets. Despite the gunner's best efforts, a pack of the beasts broke into the lines of soldiers on the ground. Ringgold's stomach clenched, her mouth going dry. Any hope she had had that Team Ghost might still find the Prophet was overshadowed by the massacre unfolding on the Vegas Strip. The New Gods had set this deception perfectly, luring her people into their clutches like a trapdoor spider. But what was their goal? To slaughter her forces? Or was something else going on? She looked around the room at the exhausted faces, scrambling to organize a battle that seemed to have already been lost. Grainy images of the variants played across many of the screens, along with a few videos of collaborators. The maps of enemy units showed several collaborator units and plenty of variants. But no chimeras. That sent another wave of chills through her. "How many chimeras have been reported?" Ringgold asked.
"I'm not sure," Sousa said. "But not many. Maybe a few dozen. Initial reports of chimeras turned out to be mostly collaborators."
Ringgold looked at the ceiling, considering the implications, mind racing. "If this really were the brains of the New Gods' operations, we would have seen more of them, don't you think?"
"Yes, I thought so too. But it's possible they're all protecting the Prophet," Sousa said.
"Or they are preparing to launch an assault while we've got all our forces on Vegas," Festa suggested. "Send warnings to every remaining outpost immediately," Ringgold said. "Every able-bodied man and woman should already be on the wall, but they need to know how serious this is. They must be prepared for anything. An attack tonight could be worse than anything we faced before."
"Yes, Madam President," Festa said.
He began making calls to the 12 outposts scattered between Houston and Key Largo, the last of the Florida outposts. A few of Cornelius's comms officers came over to him, pointing at a map they laid on the table.
"We now have alternate evacuation routes set up for the two task forces," Cornelius said. "They'll be headed north out of the city, where parts of Las Vegas Boulevard are still intact."
He used the map on the monitor to discuss the routes with Ringgold for a few minutes before Festa returned to the table. His face was awash in pallor.
"What's wrong?" Ringgold asked. "Are there problems with the outposts?"
"Worse, Madam President," he replied. "We just got a transmission from the First Fleet in Puerto Rico. Scouts have reported seeing vessels of all kinds and sizes headed toward them, like some kind of scrapped-together navy."
Ringgold didn't need to ask who those vessels belonged to.
"Put me in touch with Vice President Lemke now."
Festa tried the encrypted line to Lemke, but no one answered.
"Come on, Dan. Tell me what's going on."
The line continued to ring.
"I'm getting a new signal from the USS George Johnson," Festa said.
He patched the line in.
"Command, this is Captain Harmon of the George Johnson," the voice said. "The variants, they swam under us before we could spot them. Then they started climbing up the sides of our ships. They're overrunning the George Johnson. We can't hold them back for much longer."
Festa spoke to the captain while Ringgold went to Sousa, who was still trying to contact the vice president at Central Command.
"How could they have known about Puerto Rico?" Ringgold asked.
She lowered her head in despair, trying to make sense of what was happening. A few minutes later, the line with Captain Harmon had severed. They couldn't reconnect. The room fell into silence for several grueling moments.
"All this time we thought the science team was listening in on them," Sousa said. "Maybe they were the ones listening in on us."
Ringgold looked at the two generals, feeling sick.
"The Prophet got us to focus all our attention on Vegas, one big honey trap, while they swept through from the east."
Cornelius shook his head.
I never saw this coming either, Madam President."
"Is there anything we can do to help Central Command?" she replied.
"Nothing we send will arrive in time," Cornelius said. "We don't have the supply chains. Most of our surviving air units are focused on evacuating Las Vegas, and the few naval units stationed in Galveston couldn't make it until at least a day after the enemy arrived.
We need to put everything we have into protecting what little assets we have left," Sousa said.
He paused, appearing as if he didn't like what he was about to say next.
"Let's hope the Vice President can hold Central Command, because I'm afraid Puerto Rico is on their own, Madam President."
Azrael crouched in the open door of the M-865 Dolphin. The chopper had been recently acquired after one of their successful conquests on the east coast of Florida, yet another benefit of their dominance over the Allied states. After dealing with the general, he had left Los Alamos almost immediately to personally join another mission crucial to crippling the Allied states. He had not originally planned to go, but he could no longer rely on scions or alphas like the general to get things done for him, and this mission was too important to fail. Fortunately, by the time his flight from the Citadel had gotten him to the transfer point for this chopper, the battle over San Juan, Puerto Rico was almost won. He had arrived just in time to join the final destruction. The former Coast Guard chopper took him and six of his best hunters over the remains of the ancient walls of San Juan built during the Spanish-American War. Fires bloomed through the darkness, and tracer rounds pierced the night across the city. His forces had prioritized destroying their comms, so the Allied states had almost no warning of the destruction taking place down here. The Allied states' military still stubbornly held a few strongholds, but their navy was crushed, and soon he would unleash the beasts standing with him in the belly of the Hilo. These six represented one of his new death squads, hunters whose minds and bodies had been tuned for one thing, eliminating the most tenacious heretics. In the port, smoke fingered away from a burning helicopter on the deck of the USS George Johnson. Azrael had never met the former president that the Zumwalt-class destroyer had been christened after, but he was going to meet Vice President Dan Lemke very soon. A pair of cruisers on a frigate were tilted at odd angles, smoke rising from their superstructures from the surprise attack hours earlier. They were half-sunk just off the piers near Old San Juan, where cruise ships once docked. The remaining ships represented the majority of the once-dominant Allied States naval forces. A decade ago, an enemy helicopter would have been shot down before the pilots even saw the ships, but Azrael would be close enough to piss on them in a few moments. He watched as more of his forces skittered up the hull of the warships from the smaller yachts and motorboats pulled up alongside them. Each of the smaller vessels had been filled with a mixture of variants and scions. His faithful creatures now stalked the upper decks of the destroyer and the nearby escort ships, hunting down the scattered crew members. They had been preceded by seaborne variants with gills and webbed claws and feet who had swum underwater, then overwhelmed the crews in a surprise assault. A voice crackled over his headset.
"Private, our forces are cleaning up the last survivors over the First Fleet crew."
It was one of his faithful scions.
"Very good," Azrael said. "Have you located Vice President Lemke?"
"There's no sign of him aboard the ships."
"Alert all forces to focus their hunts. He cannot be allowed to escape."
The chopper circled low over an aircraft carrier with a top deck puckered by ruptured metal. A single team of sailors held the bridge and fired at the deck where variants advanced, using piles of debris for cover. A few bullets pinged off the chopper, and the pilots pulled away. Azrael took one last look as the chopper left them behind. Another explosion burst from inside the carrier, and it too began to list, no doubt taking on water. It was just a matter of time before Azrael's forces took the final heretics. The voice of another Scion commander broke over the comms.
"Private, we believe we've identified the Vice President's position."
"Where?"
"He was spotted in Punta del Moro. We believe there might be another sub positioned at that location."
"Take me there,"
Azrael said to the collaborator human pilot. He changed his headset channel to the naval commander.
"The heretics are trying to escape with a sub at Punta del Moro. Find it and destroy it."
He turned to the six scions in the helicopter. Before they had been chosen, they had come from different walks of life. They had risen above their frail human pasts, cut up and put back together to become something far greater. Azrael looked at the scions in turn.
"You are the best of my hunters, and tonight you get a chance to carry out your most important mission yet. Find the heretic Dan Lemke."
"We carry the faith," the six Death Squad members replied. "The first of you to find him will be rewarded with as much flesh as you can eat," he said.
Whatever human prisoner you desire will be yours.
The chopper descended over an overgrown grass field in front of the Castillo San Felipe de Moro. Layers of castle-like walls rose above choppy waves, bulwarked by towers between the gates. Azrael leapt out first, wielding his saw-toothed cutlass. The other six followed, each carrying a rifle, their swords strapped over their back. As the chopper lifted off again, the thrum of the engines faded against the cacophony of the ongoing battle. Azrael surveyed the open lawn behind them, leading to Old San Juan. Human corpses lay strewn over the grass. Thrall variants tore into them, devouring the corpses. Other prisoners were shackled by collaborators deployed to capture as many humans as they could. Those prisoners were taken to the Santa Maria Cemetery, overlooking the sea, to await their transport back to the Citadel. They were destined to become labor or food for his growing army. One of the scions near Azrael pointed a crooked, clawed finger to the gate leading into the castle.
I smell humans. Alive. They went that way.
Find them, Azrael yelled.
The six soldiers rushed through the gate and entered a cramped courtyard filled with doorways under white arches. Azrael narrowed his eyes, studying each of the sentries.
That way, the lead scion said.
The beast led them into a dark corridor. Stone steps took them down into another tunnel. Azrael sniffed the air. He could smell the stink of humans, their pungent body odor and sweat. They could not have gotten far. Darkness filled the tunnel, far too black for a human to see, but Azrael and his augmented soldiers used their enhanced sight to scan for prey as they delved deeper under the castle, north, toward where the point met the sea. If Lemke made it to those waters and into his sub, Azrael would fail. He hadn't come all the way to Puerto Rico while his forces fought the heretics in Vegas just to let one of the most powerful human beings left in the world slip so easily between his claws.
We're getting close, one of the scions said. I can smell it.
Sniffing the air, Azrael too detected the scent of flesh and fear. Though their eyesight was preternaturally strong, even they couldn't see as the final traces of surface light vanished in the tunnels. The death squad turned on the tactical lights fixed to the barrels of their rifles. Beams of white light probed the darkness, cutting through the black to reveal mold-covered stones and rubble. They took a corner, raw adrenaline filling Azrael. He grinned, imagining the fear that must be striking through Lemke at this moment. It had been too long since he had taken part in a hunt like this, and he had to hold in a primordial howl. They came to another intersection, taking a sharp left, still following the scent trail. Between the sound of their claws on the stone, Azrael heard something else. The clatter of boots and shoes on concrete.
They're just ahead, he growled.
The death squad charged, sprinting through the darkness, their lights bobbing. Muzzle flashes lit up the passage, followed instantly by the sharp crack of gunfire. One of the scions yelled out in agony, her body crumpling. The other five took cover and returned fire, allowing two of the soldiers to advance. More flashes of gunfire illuminated the tunnel in strobing blasts, and another scion went down. Azrael sighted up targets and fired at them in turn. Human cries sounded from the men caught in the hail of his bullets. Another scion crumpled from a bullet to the head, leaving only two of his soldiers. The smell of blood in the air was too strong, awakening the primal animal within Azrael.
On me! Azrael screamed.
The remaining two scions let loose a salvo that lanced into a pair of soldiers. The rest of the group of heretics disappeared around another bend in the tunnel, and Azrael barreled after them with his scions. Starlight bled into the next section of the tunnel. They had reached the end under the fortress, and a salty seaborne breeze swept through the corridor. Three human soldiers waited with their rifles shouldered. Azrael slid under the gunfire, but one of his loyal comrades was not quick enough. The beast was cut down in a spray of bullets. He fired from the ground while the final scion lay down covering fire. All three of the human soldiers slumped over, dead or dying. The screams of agony were enough to fuel Azrael and the remaining scion. He leaped over the soldiers, letting his final soldier finish them off with a cutlass. Azrael ran out into the weeds and grass of a pathway overlooking the Caribbean. Three men in ACUs ran, covering a man who had to be the vice president. The final scion joined Azrael as they stalked the human prey toward a concrete platform. Amid the choppy water crashing against the black rocks past the pathway, Azrael noticed a zodiac bobbing. Three men waited in the rigid-hulled inflatable boat. Beyond the craft, a submarine had pierced the surface of the deeper waters.
"Do not hit the heretic," Azrael said.
He raised his rifle next to the final scion and lined up the sights. Two of the soldiers collapsed under the well-aimed shots, but return fire from the Zodiac forced Azrael to roll away. He got up and charged ahead, aiming toward the third soldier. His surviving scion covered him, providing suppressing fire against the men in the Zodiac. Unstrapping his cutlass, Azrael flanked Lemke and the final soldier, catching them off guard and stabbing the guard through the guts. The man slumped against Azrael, gurgles coming from his mouth. Azrael used the man as a human shield as he strode toward the president.
"No, no, no," Lemke said, still running for the boat.
Gunfire from the remaining scion tore into the Zodiac, killing two of the three men. Azrael withdrew his cutlass and pushed the still-breathing man to the ground. Slotted eyes on the heretic, Azrael bolted forward. When he was just within reach, Azrael lunged toward him, snagging his claws through the back of Lemke's shirt. A scream rang out as Azrael pulled the vice president to the dirt. Several final gunshots rang out before the last scion ran over.
"All hostiles eliminated," he growled.
No longer masked by the sounds of gunfire, Azrael heard the churning engines of his fleet converging on the submarine still waiting for Lemke. He yanked the vice president to his face, drawing him close, eye to eye. There was certainly fear in the man's gaze, but there was also an undeniable anger.
"You won't win," Lemke said, wincing. "Oh, I have already won," Azrael snarled. "You are just too naive to see it. This is the end of the Allied States, and the end of you."
Dohai searched the patient rooms and offices on the fifth floor of the University Medical Center of Southern Nevada for some sign of the Prophet. He picked through the tangles of webbing lining a hallway as they made their way toward the administrative offices. Distant booms from the main strip still sounded like thunder, and the UMC shook slightly with each impact. It sounded like the other teams were getting pounded out there, especially from the constant chatter over the comms. Dohai had turned off the public channels to concentrate on his own team. Spearhead was in bad shape. Nielsen could hardly stand, and Toussaint had a swollen face, one of her eyes sealed shut by swelling. Fitz stayed close behind Dohai with Corin, while Rico and Ace watched their six. No one dared speak. Too many monsters stalked the corridors, searching for them. Sporadic shouts called up the stairwells. Howls and shrieks blasted through the elevator shafts. The collaborators and variants were searching the building for them, and Dohai knew it wouldn't be long before they caught up. He just hoped they found the Prophet first, assuming the beast was even still here. Every passing minute that seemed to be less likely. But something was ahead. The webbing grew denser, clogging the halls. Dohai could almost feel the network pulsating. He hacked away at clumps of webbing blocking the passage with his hatchet. Fitz used a knife to saw through strands.
"We have to be getting close."
Working together, they pushed through to an area with expansive windows that had once overlooked the surrounding medical center. Now those windows were mostly blotted with viney growths. The stench of death grew stronger, bringing with it the telltale odor of rotten fruit. His NVGs picked up what little light sifted through the windows, revealing a space choked in vines. Cubicle walls and desks had been toppled, making space for dozens of cocoons where bodies rotted, their nutrients shuttled away by the vines snaking through the corpses. Dohai breathed through his mouth, trying not to suck in the fetid odor, and continued past. A flash of movement burst through a corridor ahead. He raised his fist and counted at least 5 variants, hunched. Most of them were feeding, but a few scanned the darkness for prey. He signaled to the rest of Ghost. Fitz directed Ace and Rico to flank the variants on the right side while he and Dohai took the left. Team Spearhead stayed behind with Corrin. Dohai tried to mask the sounds of their approach, but it was nearly impossible with the slurp of his steps. Their only saving grace was another rash of explosions in the distance and the overpowering odor of the dead and dying masking their own smells. He held his hatchet at the ready, and Fitz gripped his K-bar. The variants stood in front of another set of wooden doors, which were cracked slightly open. If something was in there, maybe the Prophet. Dohai didn't want to give any warning that they were outside. He peeled back more vines until he was just a few feet from his first target variant. The beast gnawed at a bone. Another two were focused on a cocooned body, pulling out stringy lengths of flesh and chewing them. Fitz counted down with his fingers. 3. Dohai inhaled deeply, cocking back his hatchet. With his other hand, he pulled out his knife. 2. He took a step forward and aimed at the spine of the first variant. 1. Dohai lunged, swinging the hatchet. It cleaved into the creature's diseased flesh and cut into bone with a sharp crack. Fitz attacked the second, catching it from behind and sawing his knife straight through the cartilage and flesh at its throat. Ace and Rico engaged two others, leaving a final abomination that twisted toward Dohai with an open mouth, ready to let loose a shriek. Dohai threw his knife into the black hole, breaking teeth as it plunged into the throat. The monster shuddered, then fell backward. The others circled around the open doors, their targets down. Dohai wiggled his hatchet free and then retrieved his knife. Fitz signaled for Team Spearhead and Corrin to join them. Toussaint and Nielsen were in no shape to perform room-clearing maneuvers, but they kept close behind. Dohai prepared to enter what he hoped would be the lair of the Prophet. All the dense webbings led to this spot. If someone or something was controlling the operations in Vegas, it would be orchestrating the monsters from this place. He raised his rifle, heart climbing into his throat with anticipation. A nod from Fitz, and Dohai slipped into a vast room, zeroing in on movement at the opposite end. Past the stringy columns of webbing, shapes rushed their position, letting out growls and snarls. Behind them was a much larger creature, hunched to fit into the room, its flesh hanging in folds like the surface of a brain. A mastermind. But was this mastermind the Prophet? Either way, it wasn't alone. A group of variants crawled around the room. Fitz gave the order to open fire. Dohai sighted up a variant on the webbing, the others following his lead. Bullets lanced into the beasts, dropping them from the ceiling and walls. In only a few seconds, several were bleeding out on the ground. Another group of 4 careened from a side door. More suppressed gunfire echoed in the room. 2 monsters crashed forward against the webbing, dead. One of the survivors slammed against Rico, knocking her on her back. No! Fitz charged the monster and grabbed its shoulders, trying to tear it off Rico. The other variant shouldered into Ace, knocking him flat on his back. Dohai couldn't get a clear shot without risking hitting Ace. Instead, he tackled the monster, freeing Ace. The creature hissed and snapped at him, teeth coming inches from his face. Dohai pushed the head back, but it was stronger than he was, and inched toward him with jagged yellow teeth. A hulky shape lunged overhead. Ace. He wrenched the variant's head back, twisting it violently until a sickening pop echoed in the room. Ace gasped for breath, letting the monster drop, then offered a hand to help Dohai up. 10 feet away, Rico and Fitz had recovered and approached the mastermind. Only now, Dohai had time to see what kind of room they were in. Chairs were scattered throughout the space, and along